You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Berlin Wall fell 20 years ago today, and since then, historians have proposed one thesis after another to explain why it happened when it did. Some have argued that Ronald Reagan's hawkish policies accelerated it. Others that it was the anti-communist opposition within the Eastern Bloc and the courageous acts of heroism on the part of civil society. Some declared it as a triumph of capitalism, and others said Mikhail Gorbachev is responsible. Joining me now are two experts in the field, Stephen Kotkin, Rosengarten Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at Princeton University and author of Uncivil Society, 1989 and the Implosion of the Communist Establishment, which is published by Modern Library Chronicles, and Stephen F. Cohn, Professor of Russian Studies and History at NYU. His latest book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives, from Stalinism to the New Cold War, is published by Columbia University Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Professors Kotkin and Cohn back to our show today. Hello, and we have a problem here. We have two Stevens. And not only do we have two Stevens, you even though this is radio, you both spell your names with a PH. So what should we do? So Stephen Kotkin and Steve Cohn, is that okay?
I used to be called Kentucky Steve because that's where I grew up.
So I'll call you Kentucky. Yeah. Well, Stephen, were some of the histories written early on after the end of the Cold War too quick to hand most of the credit to Ronald Reagan's hawkish approach to the Soviet Union?
The idea that Reagan brought down communism is very popular in the United States for obvious reasons. The usual argument is that he pressured the Soviets, he spent a lot on the U.S. military, he introduced SDI, or Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative. The problem with this explanation is that there's no evidence for it. We have pretty good insight, not complete insight, but pretty good insight into the Soviet military-industrial complex. And the KGB said that Star Wars wasn't going to work. So the idea that Star Wars or Reagan brought down communism has this evidential problem. It also, however, occludes what Reagan's real contribution was. Reagan actually made a contribution. His contribution was that he had lifelong anti-communist bona fides so that when he went into negotiations with Mikhail Gorbachev, he had the credibility to cut deals with Gorbachev to give Gorbachev room.
So if the old theory is not true, then why do we still hear from people, I guess I would call them post-Cold War hawks, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and others, that it's the reason we should oppose negotiations with some countries, and it's why they feel that policy moves toward discussions with Iran, for example, are a big mistake?
This is a difficult question. In order to have policies that of engagement that work, the other side has to feel weak. The other side has to want to capitulate. Engagement works when the other side wants to engage too. Let's look at the very quickly at comparison between the communist stuff and the Iranian stuff or China. In 1989, there were 1 million people in the streets in Tiananmen Square. 1 million. And the communist regime is still there 20 years later. In 1989, there were no demonstrations, almost, in Poland. And Poland was the first place where communism collapsed.
But there was organized opposition.
Yes,
solidarity.
Of course. There was, but solidarity had been driven underground by that point. So let's look at Iran this past summer, where there were 2 to 3 million people in the streets in Iran, and that Iranian regime is still there. We have to look at the regimes themselves, their resolve or their demoralization, as was the case under communism.
Kentucky, Steve.
Yep. Yep.
Even before Mikhail Gorbachev took power in 1985, didn't Ronald Reagan, following up on what Stephen has said, give a speech in which he pointedly abandoned his aggressive posture toward the USSR, saying the fact that neither of us likes the other system is no reason not to talk?
Well, more than that, he even said when he was accused of not negotiating with the Soviet Union, I want to negotiate with them, but they keep dying. Because prior to the rise of Gorbachev, there had been elderly, infirm, and in fact dying Soviet leaders. On this question you ask of who should get the... the answer is there's no one answer. Lots of factors came into play, and at historical turning points, that's usually what happens. Lots of things happen at the same time. But it's fair to ask which was the most important. And Steve Kotkin's book is very, very interesting because it draws us away from this myth that that society rose up and smited these communist systems. He looks at something else, at the communist elites themselves. And I agree with him. That's where you have to focus the final analysis. But, and let me overstate the issue a bit, just for the sake of discussion. I think if Gorbachev or a Gorbachev had not come to power in the Kremlin and persisted with his determination to reform the Soviet Union, in all likelihood, the wall would still be there today and those systems. Now, having said that, let me now tell you what Gorbachev says about that, because it's very important. In the current issue of The Nation magazine, there's an interview with Gorbachev done by myself and my wife, Katrina Vandenhoevel, who's the editor of The Nation. And as he's always done in that interview, as he always has done, he gives enormous credit to Reagan, because he knows that had he not found a partner in the United States, he never could have broken down the resistance of the opposition inside the Soviet Union. So without Gorbachev, nothing, but he needed Reagan. And Gorbachev says that when they met the first time, afterwards, Reagan referred to Gorbachev as a dogmatic Bolshevik. And Gorbachev referred to Reagan as a dinosaur. He pauses and he said, and you see what the Bolshevik and the dinosaur accomplished. And I mean, that is, I mean, why they did it, these two guys came to this moment is different, but that's the way it began.
But you say if he hadn't come to power, wasn't he brought to power because they were desperate? By bringing in the old liners, the Andropovs and the like, to keep on propping up the old system, they were just exacerbating a failing system.
There's a debate among those of us who study Kremlin political history, and Steve probably has his view. There's no certain answer. But the people who chose Gorbachev, these very elderly remaining Soviet leaders of the Brezhnev generation, had choices. There were other candidates. They chose Gorbachev because, in the end, yes, they wanted a younger leader with some new ideas, but they didn't expect him to become the Gorbachev that he was.
And you agree, Stephen?
He was not on an oxygen tank. He was not on a dialysis machine. He didn't die. He wasn't clinically dead for 90 seconds and then resuscitated like Brezhnev was. He was the only person in the Soviet ruling group who was in his 50s. He was in his mid-50s at the time. The next closest people were in their late 60s, 70s, and some were in their 80s. A generational transition was going to happen at some point. They had tried to avoid it many times, but it finally came with him.
And Stephen Cohen, you say in your introduction, you quote Mikhail Gorbachev saying, "History is not determined by fate. There is always an alternative."
Well, that's the theme of my book, so I'm biased in that direction. I think there are always alternatives at historical turning points, roads taken and not taken. To bring this topic back to the question of 1989, I think, maybe you don't want to go here yet.
I'm ready to go wherever you go,
okay,
both of you.
All right, maybe let me take you along then. That after 1989, and don't separate, don't mistake, don't confuse the end of the wall with the end of the Soviet Union. They were related, but the end of the Soviet Union was not inevitable, even after the wall came down. But let's go to after the end of the Soviet Union. There was an opportunity, an alternative, a road that would have led, I think, to a permanent, lasting post-Cold War peace with Russia. And the United States did not take that road, in my judgment. That's what both Reagan and Gorbachev thought would happen as a result of their labors. And not only are the Gorbachev people bitter about what the United States did after the end of the Soviet Union, but many Reagan people are bitter because they think that subsequent American governments lost the legacy of Reagan, which was to create a real post-war relationship with Russia. So that would be the most recent lost alternative.
And you've argued over the years that history is not a foregone conclusion. It's about alternatives, what could have happened as opposed to what actually happened.
Well, it's a personal interest. It grows out of my own life. But I think that I'm interested in you come to what's clearly a historical fork in the road. That's a little too metaphorical. But why, if there are political forces representing each road at that moment, why is one taken and not the other? That's a personal interest of mine.
You reveal in the introduction to your latest book that you also have been friendly with George H.W. Bush. And now he...
Well, I wouldn't say friendly. I mean, I've been very friendly with Gorbachev over the years, and your listeners ought to bear in mind that I have a personal bias. I like the man. He's helped me. He's been kind to my
but
children.
But nobody in Russia seems to like him.
Well, a few people. His reputation is actually growing somewhat. But with Bush, I mean, the only thing I can say about the first president, Bush, he was the only American president who ever invited me to come and tell him what I thought three times. And one before, on the eve of... Malta, which, if some people will remember, was this summit between the first Bush and Gorbachev on the island of Malta, where they said at the end of the meeting, the Cold War's over. I think they were wrong, but that's what they thought at the time.
Now, Stephen Kotkin, when Gorbachev came to power, military spending in the USSR was 40%, and that really does not seem sustainable, especially in a country that had all sorts of economic problems. Do you think it was that spending that made it possible for Gorbachev to make the case that they should cut Eastern Europe free?
It's one thing to say that Gorbachev had this tremendously important role that he had. Eastern Europe collapsed, that is, communism in Eastern Europe collapsed, only months after Gorbachev said he would not intervene militarily. So the short answer to how the wall came down is that Gorbachev let it come down. Whether he fully knew what he was doing at the time, however, is a separate question. But let's remember what communism was. Communism was supposed to be the alternative to capitalism. Communism was supposed to be better than capitalism. Otherwise, communism had no reason to exist.
It was scientific, according to communist theory.
Yes, but here was the problem. You had face-to-face in Eastern Europe a West Germany and an East Germany. And in the 1950s, West Germany was growing, its GDP was growing double digits every single year. West Germany in the 50s was the China of today. And the East Germans just couldn't compete. They couldn't choose not to compete because that was the reason for being in East Germany. Their state existed in order to compete with West Germany. So communism had a really big problem. Its problem was not that it was no good maybe in and of itself. The problem was that communism had to compete against capitalism, and it got crushed in that competition. We were very fortunate that the end game of communism, how it was dismantled, it really imploded, was peaceful. That was the most important fact of 1989, and the follow-up was that there was not the kind of mass violence that we feared might happen, but communism was crushed in a competition that it had assigned itself.
Well, it was peaceful, but it's been somewhat disastrous, hasn't it, in most of the former communist countries?
I don't know if I agree with that, Leonard. I think the achievement of communism falling peacefully is the most important thing that's happened in history in our lifetime. And moreover, Eastern Europe was incorporated into the European Union. And that incorporation of Eastern Europe into the European Union, which required internal transformation of Eastern Europe, is an achievement. It's a separate issue what happened to the post-Soviet states and whether the post-Soviet states might have also had a better alternative. But there's a lot positive to say about the collapse of communism.
A listener wants to know if the two of you believe that if a Marshall-type plan had been offered to the former Soviet bloc, our relations would be better now.
I don't know about Eastern and Central Europe. I don't know. I mean, Steve Kotkin really knows those countries in a way I don't. Remember, though, if we're talking about post-Soviet Russia, what the Marshall Plan was and was not. Marshall had the idea that the post-World War II countries of Europe had to come up with their own plan of recovery, and we would then help fund it. We didn't dictate a blueprint of how they should do it. The countries were different, had to be done there. After the end of the Soviet Union, we took an opposite approach. We said, do it our way, only our way, and that was the monetarist World Bank, International Monetary Fund way, the shock therapy way for short, or we won't help you. Now, of course, they made a bad choice, the post-Soviet Russian leaders. They didn't have to do that. But I think had we gone to them in the spirit of the Marshall Plan, tell us what you think is the way for your country to recover, they would not in Russia have chosen this shock therapy, and therefore the trauma of the 1990s, which, by the way, leads to Putin, may well have been very different.
My guests are Stephen Cohn, Professor of Politics Emeritus at Princeton University, and Stephen Kotkin, joint appointment at Princeton University as Professor of International Affairs in the Woodrow Wilson School. And we are talking about, the aftermath of the fall of the Berlin Wall 20 years ago today. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. My guests are Stephen Kotkin, Rosengarten Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at Princeton University, author of Uncivil Society, 1989, and The Implosion of the Communist Establishment, published by Modern Library Chronicles. Stephen Cohn, Professor of Russian Studies and History at NYU, also Professor of Politics Emeritus at Princeton University. His latest book, Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives from Stalinism to the New Cold War, which is published by Columbia University Press. We've been hearing an awful lot of different ideas about the topic at hand. Stephen Kotkin, you say a lot of it is mythology.
Well, you know, we believe what we want to believe, and we believe in relation to our political views also. We've been hearing a lot about how the Soviet war in Afghanistan was the Soviet Union's Vietnam, for example. This is important to people who want to talk about America's role in Afghanistan today. The Soviet Union had 100,000 troops at its height in Afghanistan out of a 5-million-person army. The Afghanistan war was 1% of the Soviet military budget. The entire number of deaths in Afghanistan by the Soviets was less than the number of people who died on the road in the Soviet Union every year. The Soviet Union and Afghanistan is not a Vietnam story whatsoever, but nonetheless, we hear about that. We hear about many myths, but the biggest myths we hear are the following. On the one hand, that people in the streets and courageous intellectuals brought down communism. And on the other hand, the myth that we hear in Eastern Europe itself, which is that the old elites stole the revolution. There was a revolution, but these guys survived it. Not only did they survive it, they prospered, and they're all still in power. This is a deep story over there in Eastern Europe.
Well, that's not true. When the switch was made to capitalism, weren't the people who were running the factories suddenly the people who were owning the factories?
That was certainly true.
And in Russia, it was that plus a lot of people from the KGB who took over all of the various capitalist functions.
That was certainly true, but it presupposes that they brought the system down for that very reason. But in fact, they had no idea the system was coming down. They were as shocked as we were.
They were just in a good position.
They then took advantage of the fact that they were in the positions of a power and authority, and they ripped everything off that they could. But they did not think the system was collapsing. The system collapsed despite what they thought.
The same thing apply in Russia?
Yeah, until a moment in 1991 where and I'm speaking now only in Russia, not the other republics of the Soviet Union. There was a dramatic moment in 1991 when the nomenklatura or bureaucratic elite, party state elite, had to choose between Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin. They were the rival. Yeltsin was driving toward the dissolution of the Union. Gorbachev was determined to save the Union. Yeltsin issued a number of statements which indicated that they could take all the property they wanted. He had a slogan, "Take all the sovereignty you can swallow." But they understood that the word sovereignty meant whatever you possess, whatever you think is yours, take it. Gorbachev, on the other hand, was a socialist. He was okay with privatization to a degree, but he was against creating some kind of new oligarchical class. So the signal that Yeltsin sent, at least this is my interpretation, tilted the bureaucratic elite toward Yeltsin. Or to put it differently, it removed any incentive the bureaucratic elite had for saving Gorbachev. So in that sense, those two factors came together at a crucial moment in Russian history.
What do you think of the argument that this was really just the triumph of capitalism over totalitarian communism?
You have to remember that Eastern Europe was a little bit different from the Soviet Union. Eastern Europe hadn't won World War II. World War II had been an occupation, first a Nazi occupation, then a Soviet occupation. The Soviets won World War II. So even though communism was not a legitimate regime for many people, it was for other people in the Soviet Union, not to the same degree in Eastern Europe. The other big difference is that the East European elites had nowhere to go. If they gave up the system, where would they go? They were afraid they might go to jail. The Soviet elites, however, had a place to go. They could go from the Soviet central elite to the Russian Republic elite, or the Ukrainian Republic elite, or the Kazakh Republic elite. So when things started to look very bad for them, they could save themselves by landing in these internal republics that became the successor states of the Soviet Union. But on the capitalism question, The great thing about Eastern Europe was that all the communist elites were living with capitalist goods. The East German elite drove Volvos. They were too ashamed to drive Mercedes, which is what the mafia around the globe drives, because Mercedes were from Western Germany. So they drove Volvos, and they lived in a place called Volvograd.
And they let the hoi polloi drive the Trabats.
Yes, and they imported everything imaginable from the West, borrowing foreign currency. The Soviet elites, to the same extent, also lived taking Western capitalist consumer goods, but they didn't have to borrow money for it because they could pay for it with Soviet oil. So here's a system whose elites are living off of capitalism during the time when they are denouncing capitalism as a story. However, you have to know, and this is the most important point about the collapse of communism, you have to know that these elites therefore became demoralized. Their systems were not beating capitalism, and they themselves were living off capitalist products while denouncing it. And this process of internal demoralization is one key factor why they go more quietly than we thought they were going to go.
So many countries are involved. Certainly,
but they all supposedly had the same system because it had been imposed by the Soviet Union.
They actually didn't have this. I mean, over the years, there was evolution. Hungary was much more relaxed. It had more of a private economic sector. Yugoslavia, the same way.
Albania in the other direction.
In the other direction. Yeah, it's hard to generalize, I think, about what was emerging in those countries. Poland, I mean, you really can't call Poland a totalitarian society after the rise of Solidarity, because the whole theory of totalitarianism excluded that. I also think, not sure of Steve's view, but Russia was fundamentally different, not only because it won the war, which is, of course, enormously important, even enormously important today. And they did win the war. That's another myth that we won. It drives me up the wall when I hear about Saving Private Ryan. And when the American mythological war nostalgia machine shows the United States whipping off to Europe in 1944 to save Europe from fascism, when in fact it really was the fighting Soviet army, however badly they did it. But communism, if that's the right name for it, and I even find it hard to use this, but the Soviet system, let me put it like this, was much more national and indigenous in Russia. In Russia, at least, maybe not in the other republics. You'd have to go republic by republic about that. Much more indigenous than it was in Eastern Europe. And therefore, when the Soviet state, the state began to crumble, people had a negative nationalist reaction. They were losing their state. And when pollsters in Russia ask Russians today, do you regret the end of the Soviet Union? They don't ask if you want it back, because most don't. But do you regret it? You still get a majority who say yes, because they lost something indigenous. It's like losing a parent. You know you can't bring the parent back, but you still regret it.
Well, they were one of the two great world powers, and they are no longer.
I resist this argument that they're nostalgia for great power. I mean, people, it's an easy excuse for Washington to say that we're not responsible for anything bad Russia does today. They're just nostalgic for great power. That's all it is. They're revanchist. I mean, polls don't show that ordinary Russians particularly care about this issue. I mean, maybe the elite is. But there is something about living in dignity. There's something about being able to count on a future for your children. That was lost in Russia after 1991, and they haven't gotten it back yet.
My guests are Stephen Cohn and Stephen Kotkin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A listener left this comment on our show page. Kai from, I guess, New Jersey, New York City, it says. That's a complicated area. What about one of the bigger pieces to the collapse of the Soviet Union that we rarely talk about? It's over-reliance on petroleum revenue to prop up its state functions when oil prices were high, and then oil's precipitous price decline during the USSR's 10-year war in Afghanistan.
I think there's a point there. The Soviet Union was the world's biggest oil producer. Siberian oil was discovered in the 1960s, came online in the 70s. The oil shock of 1973 raised the price of oil by 400% in a few months. In the 1970s, the Soviets were flush with money. They had a tremendous amount of petrodollars. And it's clear that they spent that money not wisely, just like the Middle Eastern countries that were flush with petrodollars. In 1985, 1986, the price of oil collapsed. It went down to about $10 a barrel globally. That's just when Mikhail Gorbachev began his perestroika. And he began borrowing money because they didn't have the oil revenues anymore. And he went into something of a debt crisis in the Soviet Union for the first time, which Eastern Europe had been experiencing for a long time before then.
It was a factor. I wouldn't put it at the top of the list. But and Gorbachev believes to this day, I have no knowledge of the subject, that there was a conspiracy between the United States and Saudi Arabia in 85, 86 to drive oil prices down to punish the Soviet Union. Well, I don't know if it's true. I mean, we learned so much about what happened in recent history. I don't exclude it. I just don't know. But that perspective on the part of Gorbachev suggests that he thinks the collapse of oil prices was wounding.
Slavoj Zizek wrote an op-ed piece in Today's Times, and he asks, how did we come to this? Deceived by 20th century communism and disillusioned with 21st century capitalism. He also suggests that capitalism seems to be working best in the world's largest communist country, China.
You know, I mean, a lot of good has happened since 1989-91. The world is a lot freer and a lot richer. Several hundred million people in Asia have been lifted out of poverty since communism collapsed. Now, it's not exactly causal, but I can't say that the world is worse off because of communism's collapse. Freedom is a good thing. Should we put the wall back up? I don't think so. There are other issues about missed opportunities, about things that could have been done better, about politicians who could have been smarter. But the idea that we're in some type of deep fundamental crisis now on the level of the crisis of communism, I don't really buy it. On the other hand, do we have the courage to tackle the problems that we all know we do have? And I'm not sure about that either.
Let me say two things about that, since we all like anniversaries, both professors and talk show hosts. There's another anniversary that's not being mentioned, and this is the 30th anniversary of the Chinese economic reforms, which began in 1979. It may turn out to be when our grandchildren, well, I'm older than Steve Kostman.
This is Deng Xiaoping.
Yeah, but the market reforms in China, when they abandoned the Maoist-Stalinist model and they really set the Chinese people semi-free economically. It may be when Steve Kotkin's kids and Steve Cohen's grandchildren sit down to sort this out. They may think that 1979 in China was more important than 1989 in Eastern Europe, because China really is now emerging as a very large actor on the world scene, partly because of those reforms. Let me now say, go back, though, to, yes, freedom, 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 freedom. Kris Kristofferson was wrong. Freedom doesn't mean just another word for nothing left to lose, an anthem of my generation. But tragic things have happened that did not need to happen, and I don't think they're quite the sidebar to the freedom story that Steve Kotkin thinks they are, or maybe he didn't mean that. I think something very ominous is spreading across Eastern and Central Europe, and it's called NATO expansion. I think we're losing the opportunity for a united Europe. We're losing the opportunity for a permanent peace with Russia. And I think, moreover, that that little war that occurred just over a year ago in the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, which we called a Russian-Georgian war, in my judgment, and I treat it like this in my book, was actually a proxy American-Russian war. We had created the Georgian fighting force. We don't know the extent to which we unleashed the Georgians to precipitate this war. But there's a new Cold War emerging, or if we don't want to call it a Cold War, a new division whose front line now may run very close to Russia's borders through Ukraine. I mean, this is really, to me, the future of Europe now lies in Ukraine. Because if we push NATO there, I am 99% certain that Ukraine will split, there'll be a divided Ukraine, and we'll end up with something approximating what we had in Germany, which was far from the Soviet Union, right on Russia's border. And that, of course, given all the nuclear implications, I would not care to have my kids or grandchildren live in that kind of institutionalized situation.
Steve Kotkin.
I opposed NATO expansion early on because I thought it would weaken NATO. That is to say, there were many arguments against NATO expansion. One was that it would anger the Russians. Having lost everything that they lost in the collapse of this gigantic Soviet empire, they were going to be angry regardless of what we did. Whether what we did was right or wrong, they were going to be angry. But NATO's expansion has weakened NATO. It was a really important institution as important as the economic miracle in Germany, if not more important, or related to it. So it's a shame. NATO is losing its first war ever, by the way, in Afghanistan as we speak.
But I don't even understand the justification of NATO if it was originally meant to be the opposition of, you know, it and the Warsaw Pact countries were face-to-face with each other. There are no Warsaw Pact countries
anymore. You're exactly right. But let's remember how NATO expansion started. It started because the Germans didn't want to be on the edge anymore. They wanted to be in the middle. The first round of NATO expansion was not an American initiative primarily. It was a German initiative. Once NATO expansion got underway, then the issue was where are you going to stop it? Who's not going to get in? But there was European Union expansion at the same time, and the enlargement of the European Union was a fantastic policy that I have supported from the beginning, too.
Last words, Stephen
Well,
Cohen.
Last word is that I hold Clinton responsible for the expansion of NATO and violating the American promise to Gorbachev that it would not happen. Germany played a role, but the Clinton administration did something it shouldn't have done, and I agree with Steve Kotkin. Once it was done, where do you draw the line? Who do you not bring in? Now it became a kind of belonging, but I think it's so dangerous, and it is reduced. I think it's reduced everybody's security, because security comes through diplomacy, not through an ancient military alliance, and it is reduced any incentive the small countries on Russia's borders have for doing diplomacy with Russia. They feel fine punching Russia in the nose and running and hiding behind NATO and the United States. Almost no meaningful, though it's beginning in Poland, I have to say, but very little meaningful diplomacy is occurring between Russia and its smaller neighbors. That's the road to security for everybody.
Stephen Cohen's latest book is Soviet Fates and Lost Alternatives from Stalinism to the New Cold War. It's published by Columbia University Press. And Stephen Kotkin's latest book, with a contribution by Jan T. Gross, is Uncivil Society, 1989, and the Implosion of the Communist Establishment. And this is really from
Random House Modern Library Chronicles.
Yeah, it's one of those complicated things. It's a modern library book. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Leonard. Thank you very much.